Hello, this is Chris with the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, January 27th. We'll begin today's reading on the front page. Indy's top cop cut his teeth in Champaign-Urbana. Taylor rose through the ranks, starting out as Champaign's youngest rookie from Indianapolis. Growing up in Champaign, Randall Taylor didn't have a burning passion for any certain career. His father, a University of Illinois professor of veterinary medicine, died of cancer when Taylor was only 7. His mother was an accountant in the grants and contracts office at the U of I. It wasn't until age 18 when he got a traffic ticket from a man he would grow to respect and admire that the Carrie Busey Elementary, Jefferson Middle School, and Centennial High School graduate had a thought that police work might be a career option. Boy, did he pick well. Late last month, the 55-year-old Taylor, who began his law enforcement career in his hometown in 1987, was named chief of the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, where he leads a staff of 1,740. "I still love it," he said of the work that many of his colleagues retire from at his age. Taylor won't do that anytime soon. He promised the mayor of Indianapolis at least 4 years on the job. From his early days patrolling the streets of Champaign to years of investigating child abuse and drug dealers to getting into police administration in Indianapolis, the former Parkland College student has made a positive impression in his field. An only child of only child parents, Taylor said his memories of his late father, Paul L. Taylor, are dim. His mom, Nellie Taylor, never remarried but did her best to expose her son to positive male role models. She died in 2005 but saw her son promoted all the way to lieutenant with the Marion County Sheriff's Department. In 2007, that department merged with the Indianapolis Police Department into the agency that Taylor is leading now. Taylor said he was probably 18 when he was pulled over by Richard Adkins, one of the few black officers in the Champaign Police Department back then. "I worked at the White Hen Pantry at Kirby and Mattis. He would come in when I worked overnight. He started talking to me and telling me about law enforcement. He would check on me and let me do ride-alongs until I was 21 and could test for a police officer position. I went to Parkland College and was first looking into accounting like my mom. Finally, I looked at law enforcement and took some classes but didn't finish. That's because he was hired by Champaign at the age of 22. At the time, he was the youngest rookie in the department, fodder for a young television reporter's desire to package his story with that of one of the oldest rookie. Max Hinton was 55 or 56 when we started. He had been with the police state department, Illinois State Police, in the early 1960s, then got out of police work. He was a chicken farmer, I think. This guy was incredible physical shape. None of us could keep up with him on the runs. Sandra did a story on him being the oldest rookie. That's where we started talking and we got married in 1989. Sandra Chapman was a rookie reporter at WICD Television, Channel 15 in Champaign. Now with WTHR Television in Indianapolis, Chapman is an award-winning investigative reporter and the mother of Taylor's 3 children. Their oldest son, now 27, was born in Champaign. Their 24-year-old son and 19-year-old daughter came after the couple moved to Indianapolis. It was her desire to move to a larger television market that pulled them to Indianapolis. She was born and raised in Fort Wayne and got hired full-time at WISH-TV, where she had interned in college. Taylor tested with the Sheriff's Department, one of 1,300 people, vying for 13 open spots. "I was one of the lucky 13. I really believe God had his hand working in that," Taylor said of the career move. Despite being gone from home for more than 26 years, Taylor said he has great memories of Champaign. "I always stop in Champaign when we go to see our daughter in college. I remember when Marketplace was really small," Taylor said, marveling at the city's growth. He recalls fondly his first field training officer, Zane Ziegler, a retired Champaign patrol officer who works with the department now as a certified technical investigator and serves as its unofficial historian. I remember Randy taking me to meet his mom, and she made me promise to see that he didn't get hurt on the job. Randy was a natural, and you just knew he was going places, the nicest guy you'd ever meet. Taylor had his own humorous story about learning on the job from Ziegler. He was big enough that I could be totally behind him and you wouldn't see me, said Taylor, a small, wiry guy in his younger days. Taylor recalled standing behind Ziegler as the experienced officer knocked on a door of a man with a beef. The guy comes out and he had some complaint about a black man and was using the N-word. Zane said, "I'm going to let you tell Officer Taylor about it," and I stepped out from behind him. "We had some fun with that," he said of the complainant's reaction to having a black officer try to help him. When he left the Champaign Police Department, Taylor was the DARE, Drug Abuse Resistance Education Officer, a precursor to today's school resource officers working under the tutelage of Atkins, the guy who drew him into his career. Despite little knowledge of Indiana's state capital, Taylor quickly grew to love the city. When I moved to Indianapolis, I was on the street as a sheriff's deputy. I worked narcotics and vice for a short stint, then ended up in child abuse for the majority of my investigative career. Then I went to internal affairs. Although he wasn't looking to get into administration, Taylor took advantage of openings as they came up. His first promotion to sergeant made him realize he enjoyed being a supervisor. As the sheriff's and the city police departments merged, Taylor was a lieutenant, then later appointed a commander of community affairs, one of three assistant chiefs of police, then the only assistant chief, and just last month, the chief. Prior to talking with the News Gazette on Saturday, Taylor had been at the funeral of a murder victim, a grim but important task he's committed to for about 6 years. "We had 152 murders last year. It's crazy, but it's down from 158 the year before," he said, estimating he's attended 200 funerals in the last 2 years. "Why? My father-in-law was a murder victim in Fort Wayne back in 1998. I was a young man. I identified with a lot of families. That's why I come out and pay my condolences and make sure that they are connected with the detective that has the case. If I can, I try to let them know that as a department, we do care. It doesn't matter what they were involved in. It is someone who left the earth by gun violence. That's what most of them are, and it's unacceptable. When you're trying to bring those numbers down and have those difficult conversations, including those with parents who need to hold their children accountable. We're trying to find a clearinghouse so people can go to one spot and find what they need, be it education, jobs, or mentoring," he said, of some of the underlying systematic issues surrounding violence. Circling back to his roots, Taylor said poverty and not having two parents is no excuse to be a criminal. He pointed to a friend from his childhood who grew up in a rough North Champaign neighborhood and who has made a good life for himself. He didn't have parents, but he had family who looked out for him. Also on the front page, plotting a new course. Company in charge of turning greens into green space says plans will broaden the appeal of a subdivision and home values should go up, from Urbana. Steve Applebaum heard the complaints from the neighbors of the former Decatur Lake Golf Course in Broadhead, Wisconsin, when it closed down last year, suffering the same fate as 18 other struggling courses. After buying the land with a few partners, Applebaum had big plans. His group would create an ecological reserve, as Applebaum's company, Applied Ecological Services, has done to golf courses and open spaces across the country. They'd plant local plants and grasses to form landscape made up of prairie and savanna. In the meantime, last year, they planted fields of sunflowers as a transitional crop to prepare the soil for its new use. Landowners were initially skeptical. What we learned is that there was considerable angst and anger and uncertainty and mythology by the landowners in the homes initially concerned about the myth of home values declining, said Applebaum, who received a master's degree in ecology from the University of Illinois in 1978. We also learned that of all the homeowners, a very small percentage of them are actually golfers. But those golfers are very, very upset by losing their golf course, even though there are four or five other courses within a 45-minute drive. So Applebaum invited residents to the former course for open houses. They held pig roasts, banquets, and other meetings to show off their master plan and refer residents to other housing developments with similar reserves that applied ecological services as built on. That includes Prairie Crossing, a neighborhood that has received wide national acclaim and attention during its 30 years as what its website calls a conservation community. He also showed them the fields of beautiful sunflowers planted on the former golf course, now known as Three Waters Reserve. Boy, did that open people up to think differently about that golf course, even the adamant golfers. We stopped hearing about angst. We started to hear about enthusiasm for the flowers and the wonderful birds and butterflies that showed up. And that seemed to be a major turning point in that project as far as the experience we were having with the people that were concerned prior to that. Resident Alexander Stolier walked along Stone Creek Golf Course in Urbana last Wednesday, bundled up on a cold day. Stolier doesn't golf, but he's disappointed by the Atkin Group's recent announcement that it'll close the course, which is surrounded by a large subdivision of the same name. If things would stay as they are, I would prefer it. We need to see the plans. We need to see what they come up with. We don't play golf, so it's not like we moved here because we like to play, but we do like a nicely maintained green space around. I doubt it'll be as well maintained if it's just a park. Homeowners across the neighborhood have similar concerns whether they golf or not. Rod Fletcher pounded signs into his front yard that read, "Keep the course, say no to Atkins, and protect your property." Fletcher golfs at the course regularly. His was one of the first houses built in the neighborhood, and he moved there 17 years ago partially because of the course. "There's a lot of upset people," he said. "I just hope the Atkins group puts in some due diligence and moves forward. A park or wildlife reserve is not attractive to me." Nina and Al Heckman's floor-to-ceiling windows on the back wall of their home look out onto the course. Neither of them golf, but they're hoping to sell in 4 to 5 years to move into a retirement community. They're worried that their home values will plummet. Like Applebaum, realtors in the area don't seem to think home values will drop. Jillian Landon of Ryan Dallas Real Estate says that a different use of the land will attract a wider spectrum of home buyers. "I think with any subdivision that's centered on one major feature, like a golf course, or even a specific property that's centered around a specific feature, like a swimming pool, the buyer pool for a property like that might be more narrow and less mainstream. People are very receptive to the idea of living in a park-like setting or having that green space around them, which a golf course offers, obviously. But with it being general green space that anybody can potentially use, that's going to broaden the appeal, and people are really drawn to that. And so that's why this might be exactly what Stone Creek needs. A majority of the neighborhood's empty lots, which are numerous, are owned by the Atkins Group. Still, Fletcher is unconvinced and remains hopeful that the golf course can somehow remain in business. Losing the course is certainly a big loss in terms of property value. Hopefully, someone can step in and take over the golf course. The Atkins Group, which declined to speak for this story, began sending out weekly emails in the 2 weeks after announcing the course's closure. In its original statement posted on the website, the group laid out vague plans to provide more natural green open space, walking trails, and other community benefits. But in an effort to assuage homeowners' concerns, the emails were more detailed. In them, they presented a loose plan and announced that they were engaging with Applied Ecological Services, Applebaum's company. They laid out a rough schedule for developing a master plan, the planting of transition vegetation this March through June, and final planting for successful sustainability next February and March. While he wouldn't talk about Stone Creek specifically because the project is in its preliminary stages, Applebaum said his company has worked on around 30 golf course conversions. In addition to Three Waters Reserve, two other golf course projects are in the process. What we've learned about working with golf course communities without golf courses is that the premiums and the values of the houses don't go down. In fact, the permanently protected open space, especially with these natural attributes that we're talking about, actually has higher value than golf courses where there's no certainty on the future of whether the golf course will remain a golf course. Applebaum said the land used for these projects is legally protected with conservation easements. They're generally maintained with endowment funds that are professionally managed by money managers to generate the revenue needed to finance the perpetual management and maintenance of these landscapes. The benefits, he says, are numerous. At the former golf course where Three Waters Reserve now sits, 34,000 pounds of fertilizer were used each year. Fertilizer damages the environment in multiple ways, including the inducement of increased carbon dioxide emissions from the soil and water pollution. The water quality downstream in the river is definitely measurably improving, he said of the Three Waters Reserve. There's all kinds of wildlife coming along. You can't believe the amount of people that come out to watch birds and butterflies and walk the trails. There's human health benefits walking those trails. There's family events. People just come out and put a blanket down and have a picnic. High school graduates come out and do their high school graduation photos. It's so intriguing how the community that never participated with the land when it was a golf course, because they don't golf, and now everybody's got access to this beautiful landscape. On a recent trip to Urbana, Applebaum spotted a few red foxes and mink. Those species, along with birds, butterflies, and other animals and insects, will slowly begin to inhabit the former golf course if and when the plan takes place. A conservancy wouldn't solve one of Fletcher's main concerns, the lack of the ability to golf in his neighborhood. But instead of a fairway, the Heckman's back windows will look out into a native prairie. Instead of a golf cart track, Stolyar will walk on a trail designed for that activity, passing by native animals and birds as he goes. And concerns about the mythology of home values and golf courses, it plays out similarly to Applebaum's other projects and will melt away. Residents simply need time to come around on projects like this, and usually they do, even the golfers like Fletcher. There are so many pluses. All we hear from people who live on the conservancies his company has worked on is how much they appreciate the change. It's a different perspective and a healthier landscape and a very interesting new relationship between people that had a lot of pride living on a golf course and now they have a lot of pride helping out with this conservation park. It's so exciting to see the shift. And from Ann Arbor, Michigan, rest of Big Ten looking up at Illini. Team hasn't been alone atop league this late since 2006. Illinois men's basketball has just about worn out any sentence that starts with first time since in the last 3 weeks. On January 8th came the program's first win at Wisconsin since 2010. That was followed by Tuesday's first win at Purdue since 2008. Saturday provided a twofer. The Illini 64-62 road win against Michigan, clinched by another Ayo Dosunmu game winner, was their first in Ann Arbor since 2010 and put them atop the Big Ten standings by themselves. The 21st-ranked Illini have a half-game lead on number 11, Michigan State. Tom Izzo and his Spartans can jump back into a tie with a win at Minnesota. Regardless, it's the first time since 2006 that Illinois has led the conference this late in the season. That year, the Illini ultimately wound up tied for second. Coach Brad Underwood didn't quite know how to describe his team's status as the top team in the Big Ten going into play. "Geez, I don't know," he said. "I guess it means BTN's The Journey comes in our locker room after the game and maybe the networks talk about us as a top 25 team. I don't know. We've got 11 more to go. I don't even like to think about that. I'm thinking about enjoying this 1 minute and figuring out what's next on our schedule. We've got 11 more. We're not even halfway through yet." DeSumo spurned the NBA draft last April and returned to Illinois for his sophomore season with the idea of unfinished business, following a freshman year that saw Illinois go just 12-21 to set a program record for the most losses and miss the NCAA tournament for the sixth straight year. Illinois wound up 7-13 in Big Ten play last season, tied for 10th. "We want more," DeSumo said on Saturday. "Great win, but now we've got to get ready for Minnesota. We're not done." Illinois, which last won a Big Ten title in 2005, when Bruce Weber's team came within one victory shy of an NCAA championship, will put its Big Ten leading six-game winning streak on the line at 6:30 p.m. Thursday at State Farm Center against the Gophers. It's the next step toward the "more" the Illini want. Assistant coach Chin Coleman delivered the mantra for that. Coach Chin, he made a great point. He said, we didn't come this far to come this far. We're trying to go bigger and better places. That's why DeSumo's focus was already on the team's 1 p.m. practice at Euban Basketball Complex, not the team's third road win in January. His teammates were of the same mindset. "Being the number one team right now is a different feeling, but that's not enough. We're going to keep fighting and try to win it all. That's our goal." Sirens to be tested as part of digital upgrade. An upgrade of the emergency outdoor warning sirens this week means people in Champaign, Urbana, and Savoy are likely to hear loud whines when there is no weather crisis. Champaign County Emergency Management Agency Director John Dwyer said between 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. Monday through Friday this week, all 39 sirens in Champaign, Urbana, and Savoy and on the University of Illinois campus will be tested by Braniff Communications as part of a modernization. Basically, they have to touch every siren for it to be upgraded from analog to digital. Dwyer expects the test will be short, as in spurts of several seconds, depending on what tweaking needs to be done. The new system, estimated to cost $63,000, allows for the automatic activation of the sirens whenever the National Weather Service issues a tornado warning. Currently, someone has to go over, stick a key in, and turn it, and punch a few buttons. After the upgrade, it will be tied to the Weather Service warning, and certain computers at Metcad will be able to activate the sirens from desktop computers. It's been a long time coming. Dwyer and his agency remind residents that outdoor sirens are intended to alert people who are outdoors that a tornado warning has been issued. If you hear the steady tone of a siren during severe weather, you should take shelter immediately. Residents should listen to a local media outlet or NOAA weather radio, or check the National Weather Service website during bad weather. And from the local page, upcoming exhibit explores Champaign-Urbana stalwart McKinley. The Champaign County History Museum recently inaugurated the Who We Are Stories of Champaign County Gallery with the Great Harris Mansion Heist exhibit. The popular When We Went to War exhibit remains on display. Upstairs, the Art of Louise Woodruff is in the Corridor Gallery. We are within a few weeks of opening an exhibit telling the stories of the Illinois Traction System and William B. McKinley. The McKinley name is familiar in the area through the former McKinley YMCA, the McKinley Fields, the McKinley Health Center on campus, and the McKinley Memorial Presbyterian Church. William McKinley was generous in public philanthropies, private gifts, and bequests. Born in 1856, McKinley came to Champaign in 1858 with his parents and later attended the University of Illinois. He became a partner in his Uncle James McKinley's baking business in 1877. His interest in public utilities developed soon after. McKinley was active in the organization and construction of the local waterworks, franchised in 1884, and the United Manufacturing Company, formed in 1889. It took over the waterworks and the plant of the Western Electric Light Company, which had been in operation since the fall of 1885. Both plants had been constructed and operated by Mr. McKinley. McKinley bought the local street railway, gas, and electric systems from B.F. Harris. He went on to develop urban electric railways, creating the Danville, Urbana, and Champaign Railway Company. He extended the system to Decatur in 1907 and later consolidated other lines and extended the system to Springfield, Peoria, and East St. Louis. The line grew in popularity and size and was known as the McKinley System and later the Illinois Traction System. During the height of its popularity, the system operated sleeping cars, diners, and observation cars, in addition to regular passenger cars. McKinley was elected to the University of Illinois Board of Trustees in 1902. He was elected to Congress as a representative in 1904 and then as a senator in 1920. As a congressman, McKinley was well-traveled, having crossed the Atlantic 30 times and circling the globe 3 times, visiting nearly every country. Senator McKinley died in December 1926 following an 8-month-long illness. The Champaign County History Museum collects artifacts relevant to the county donated by people who want to help preserve the county's history. The resulting collection sometimes needs to be supplemented with borrowed items to better tell county stories. Dale Jenkins has published a book on Illinois traction history and serves as president editor of the Illinois Traction Society. He has amassed a huge collection of ephemera and artifacts from the Illinois traction system, and we are especially grateful for his generosity in sharing his knowledge and loaning artifacts that have enhanced his new exhibit. He has agreed to present a talk on the traction system. The date will be announced on the museum website. And from Urbana, no charges against President. She allegedly hit her husband. The Champaign County State's Attorney's Office will not file any criminal charges against the president of the University of Illinois Alumni Alliance in connection with her arrest Thursday for domestic battery. Jennifer Diliao, 61, who listed an address in the 3500 block of Lakeshore Drive, was arrested by Champaign County Sheriff's deputies for allegedly striking her husband. We met with her husband, and he wants to resolve this through counseling in their marriage. Champaign County Sheriff's Apperson said at 9:40 p.m. Thursday, a MedCAD telecommunicator sent deputies to the couple's home in West Champaign in response to a 9/11 hang-up call. Dispatch heard yelling on an open line, but no one responded. Deputies learned that Diliao and her 59-year-old husband had been involved in a verbal argument that turned physical. She admitted that she hit him, Apperson said, and videotaped that the president took during their altercation led deputies to conclude that she was the aggressor, which prompted her arrest. The husband declined any medical treatment. Diliao is the first woman to serve as permanent president of the U of I Alumni Association, now referred to as the Alumni Alliance. She also has the title of Associate Vice Chancellor for Alumni Relations. Last spring, she was honored by the Champaign-Urbana Schools Foundation as one of its distinguished alumni. Diliao is a 1977 graduate of Centennial High School and also graduated from the U of I. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, January 27th. Please stay tuned.